I did something really embarrassing the other day. I was on the train, had my mask on, went for a drink of water, completely forgot that I was wearing a mask. And so just sort of poured the water into the mask and down myself, and then just had to kind of style it out. Even though I had like a huge wet patch, like, so yeah.
Did anyone see?
Yes. Yes, people saw. And I was damp, but like that was right at the start of the journey as well. I had like 2 hours to go. Incredibly embarrassing.
That's so good.
Hello everyone, and welcome to episode 5 of Cyber Sounds, the show in which we take an entertaining look at all things cyber. I'm Ollie Dent, and I'm a partner in the cyber and data risk team at Kennedy's. As always, I'm joined by my fellow partner Tom Pelham.
Hello.
And associate Lizzie Bardsley.
Hello.
On this episode, we're talking about the comms response to a cyber attack, and we're really excited to welcome Hannah Cambridge, a director in the Crisis and Issues team at Fleischmann Hillard. Hannah has dealt with some of the biggest cyber attacks in the market, and many of these you will never have heard of, which is testament to the work that Hannah and her team do. Hannah, welcome to the pod.
Thank you very much. Hi, everyone.
So we've worked together for a number of years now, so we obviously know each other pretty well, but in terms of everyone who's listening today, if you could just talk a little bit about yourself and explain how you got into comms.
Sure. So we know each other very well now. So I work at Fleischmann Hillard, as you've mentioned. I work predominantly on crisis and issues. So that can be all manner of things in all different types of sectors and representing businesses, large and small. So we work on legal matters like public inquiries, court cases. We can do product recalls, workplace matters, some pretty horrific workplace issues. Actually, it's strange how common these things are. So it's really broad, the work that we do. And as you know, we obviously do a lot in the cyberspace as well. But in terms of how I got into this, it's a bit of a roundabout way. I didn't go directly into communications, I have to say. I actually studied law at university, and I really enjoyed it. So no disrespect to the great work that you guys do, but it wasn't for me. I really struggled with the fact that there were so many grey areas in the law. So I couldn't really get over that, actually. So I left university, had my degree, didn't do too badly, but didn't really know what I wanted to do. And someone recommended that I explore this world of communications. So I got my first job, and I was lucky enough to be somewhere where they had their first ever law firm client, and they didn't really understand how lawyers worked. And we're talking about lawyers who refused to type. So if you sent them a document, their PA or legal secretary or somebody would print it out, and then they'd scribble all over it, and then they'd have to scan it in and send it back to you. And just that whole way of working, the company I was working for just didn't really get it. So yeah. I brought to them the legal bit as much as I could with the experience I had, and they taught me comms from the ground up. So with that in mind, doing all that legal work, I kind of got a bit of a taste of crisis and issues, and also data. So we did a lot of work around Max Schrems and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So from then on, it was crisis and issues specialty, really. And prep me pretty well for the cyber stuff that I work with you guys on.
Yeah, absolutely. What sort of proportion of your work is cyber then? Is that the largest part of your practice?
I think if you look at the whole team, it's probably 50% of the work we're doing at the moment. Okay. Without a doubt, the last year to 18 months has ramped up a lot in ransomware, as it will have done for you guys as well. But we work a lot with some of the bigger brands on non-cyber things as well, which is that workplace piece or supply chain issues, that kind of thing. And that's all day, every day as well for some of the teams. So we're lucky that we've got a pretty big team of experienced kind of corporate comms experts who have a crisis edge to them as well. So it's a good mix, which most of us who work in this space like, because we like projects and we like a bit of diversity of the work we do.
So, Han, in the days of social media, how hard is it to control messaging when you're dealing with a crisis situation? Because I assume going back 20 years or so ago, it must have been a lot easier to have a message and control that message.
Yeah, social media can also be your friend, though, at times, because if your message lands well and people buy into it, it can help to spread across social. So we have had that before too, where, you know, your message really does chime, even if it's bad news, with the consumers of a brand. And they are often, especially if it's a really kind of heartfelt brand, they are almost your biggest advocates. So you don't have to push out that message quite as much because they can do it for you. But absolutely, without a doubt, it is hard on social media because, you know, people can go to social media to find out what that core and first message might be and see what someone else is saying and completely kind of miss what your own brand is saying. So it's really important to factor in all the time. We have to have conversations with our clients about how much do you use social media and where do people go to social media to find out about you and what you're saying. And, you know, there's no point us focusing all our attentions on Twitter if actually everybody who follows your brand goes to Instagram to find out what's going on. So it's not just the social element, but it's also getting the platforms right and the tone right and that kind of thing. So absolutely, it's got to be a big consideration for a lot of companies, whether it's reactive or proactive, and how you use it and how your message will land on social is really, really important. And again, you know, if people take that message and manipulate it or change it in any way, you can then adapt your message if it's not landing. So that, again, it's another opportunity that comes with social media. If you can see that things are getting out of control or if there's misinformation spreading, you can see it on social before it hits the press, and you can hopefully then jump in and try and kind of correct and re-steer things back to the direction you want to go to.
Is it always possible to predict how things are going to play out on social media?
It depends mostly on what the incident is and how well the company you're talking to, how well your client really knows how social will play out for them generally as well. So what we'll do is we'll take a snapshot of what the client thinks their social media following is like and how people tend to respond, and then combine that with our experience of how a particular incident like this amongst that type of demographic has responded in the past, and sort of combine that expertise together to predict how things can go. And generally, I think I'd say we predict pretty well. Where things can go awry is normally if you've got maybe an employee who goes a bit wild on social media, or there might be some social media history that we didn't do necessarily a full check on for various different reasons, and there might be something historic. So I think you can, to a degree, actually have quite a lot of, not control, but awareness of what might happen and then mitigate against it. But, you know, there will always be things that can catch you out here and there, and then we just have to act quickly if we can to do something about that. But I think the general cardinal rule with social media is don't just delete the things you don't want to be on there that said about you. Don't try and hide what people are saying. You know, let people have that conversation and try and direct them in the right place.
The historic thing has really become an issue, hasn't it, with people's personal social accounts in particular. And digging out sort of old tweets or things that people have put on TikTok. I mean, there's been things in the news today about one particular artist. Does your team deal with any of those personal PR issues for people, or people in the public eye, celebrities or anyone like that who've had a something dug out or bad press brought up about them, about something they said on social in the past?
When we get those issues, which we've had, it tends to be if you've got a brand working with an influencer, for example, and something comes up about that influence that they've said in the past or how they've acted in a way in the past online. Or it could be, you know, a very senior leader who might be, you know, gunning for the chief exec role or something. And actually we can be asked, can you guys find out online what the skeletons are in the closet? But we're very much doing that for the company or for the organization or for the brand rather than for the individual. So we then will take that information and obviously work with them when with that individual to kind of assess, what does that mean? Does that change anything? Does that change how we might use you in the future? And do we need to prepare anything? Not necessarily to kind of go outwardly public, but if it comes to light, and obviously there are some things in the, my personal opinion on this, no one really understood what social media was going to blow up to be in the future when it first started. Mm. And people said things that they didn't ever think would get out. And I mean, when I was at university, people would constantly be logging on to other people's social media profiles and saying stuff, and it would then just be in our name. So I've no idea what could come up.
So, I mean, I guess with the with that sort of historic element, that's when it becomes a problem with cyber, doesn't it? Because journalists, it's always easy, or you could say lazy journalism, because all they need to do is to dig out some skeletons in the closet, throw that into the mix with the cyber incident, and suddenly they've got a piece about you know, how the company is out of control, or you know, they'll try and link something that's happened in the past with something that's happened now.
Yeah, they'll kind of try and kind of sort of conflate different issues and make it into a bigger issue than it is. And also, just there are things which you wouldn't necessarily immediately think about, but if a week before you go out saying you've had a cyber incident, you were messaging about, I don't know, employees having training on good cyber practice, or you know, click here on our link if you want to find out more about how we handle your data, or, and obviously that's not relevant to all organizations, but for some it really is, and then a week beforehand they're effectively giving advice to people. Or the first tweet that they do after an incident is to give advice to people. And so it's just really judging the sentiment and asking them to go back and have a look in their social history, their recent social history, to see if there's anything which can just trip you up, because we can be so in control of a lot of the messages. And then these are the kind of like little hurdles that something can just come out of nowhere. It might be nothing, and obviously we can handle it either way. But if you can avoid it, it's really good to just thinking about what's the next piece of content that's going to go up after all this has died down, and after your consumers, you know, may have been really, really angry with you. So is the best thing to do then tweet about how great your customer service has been? Probably not. Yeah. You might want to hold that one for a week or so. So just really having your finger on the pulse and thinking, if I was a consumer, what would I want to read? And what do I not want to hear?
Hannah, over the last certainly year or so, there's been a noticeable uptick in the media's reporting on cyber incidents and data breaches. Do you think this is a kind of passing trend, a fashion, or do you think this is the start of something that will just continue, and in 2030 you will still be seeing these reports of blue chip companies being hit by data breaches?
So journalists like a story that's going to make an impact and tell the truth and, you know, really maybe have a longer thread to the end of it, maybe last a bit longer in the news, get picked up by other outlets, and that kind of a story. And actually, if you're talking about what unfortunately has become a sort of bog standard cyber incident, then when maybe a couple of hundred, maybe a couple of thousand individuals are notified, there's going to be less and less to say that's different. And so, and people don't want to read the same story repeatedly in the press. But I think with more reporting comes more understanding, and there'll be more comparison as to how different brands have responded to an incident. So, certain football club, for example, were very honest and open about the fact they had this cyber incident, and the fact of their transparency was reported really positively, almost more than the incident itself. So I think it will just change to become more about how a company responds to an incident rather than the fact that the incident has occurred. But also, we don't know what the threat actors are going to do. We don't know what their next, you know, big technique is going to be. They've got so creative, you know, some of the phone calls that we know that they're making, they can really upset people. It makes it much more of a personal attack rather than something that someone behind a screen that's faceless. So I think seeing what they do will be interesting as well. We know from the US pipeline and from the issues in Ireland that actually bad PR is not good for a lot of the threat actors. So will they maybe become less creative to try and avoid being in the press? I do think a big leverage for them is people are more likely to pay a ransom if they don't want people to know about the incident. If everyone knows about it, then they lose that leverage, don't they? So yeah. I think a part of how it's going to be reported by the press will also be determined by what they come up with next.
We were talking about this the other day, actually, and one trend that we've seen in terms of media reporting, I don't know whether you'd say the same thing, but we found that the media seems to be more interested if there's operational disruption rather than a data breach. Is kind of shifted, and it's almost the colonial pipeline effect, because that caused so much disruption that, you know, obviously it's a big thing for a lot of people, and it affects more people than are actually maybe affected in terms of data that's been compromised. And we've dealt with tons of cyber incidents now, and lots of them haven't made the media, but the ones that have are the ones where the company's not able to deliver their products on time, and so there's been a delay, and then that causes lots of interest. So it's almost that operational issue rather than the data itself.
Yeah, and I think with that comes the pressure from journalists to say earlier that it is some kind of a cyber incident, and then they also would love you to say it's ransomware. So I think that it helps to create that story as well. And nowadays too, I hate to say this, but it's really annoying to get a new passport, but you can get a new passport, and you can get new credit card details, and you can get a new email address if you want to. So a lot of that, the impact of it is sort of replaceable nowadays too. And I think journalists have become a bit more used to that. But they obviously still love big numbers. So if you're talking about millions of data subjects, then that is still an interesting story. Also, we don't really know where the civil litigation side is properly going to go. So I guess that will be another wave that can come too.
Here's a question for you, Han. In your eyes, what do you think is a true PR disaster? So at what point do you think something's gone, you know, gone really bad? Is it when it gets into the Daily Mail, or is it when it just blows up on social? Is there a trigger point where you think, it's gone out of control now?
Definitely not the Daily Mail one. We had one, I think Tom was working with you on it, wasn't I? We had Daily Mail coverage. It was basically an advert for our client.
Yeah, it was brilliant.
They couldn't have paid for much better. And all their products on the celebrities were in the pictures. It was brilliant. I think for me, it's when the response to the incident is, or whatever's occurred, and it's the response that becomes the story. I think that's really the problem. Whether it's, the CEO shoves a journalist who's doorstepping them, or people can't get through on the phones, and then that causes loads of problems, or whatever that impact might be, whatever that response is. Personally, it would be if the comms response causes any of those things to happen. And that would be obviously a disaster. Haven't known that yet. Just to put that there. I think that is when you're really into more out of control territory, because you've lost control of the message then. You've lost control of being in control of the incident. You've lost control of the message. Someone else is running away with the story. So for me, that's sort of worst case scenario. You can pull it back, but pretty worst case scenario, yeah.
Yeah, do you think there is a point of no return, or do you think anything is recoverable to some extent?
I think as long as you take action, if you need to, as an organization or as an individual, then it can be recoverable. And some organizations will maybe try and get away with not doing remedial action straight away. But then if an incident like that occurred again, then the first time it happened will always come back. You know, why didn't you learn any lessons? Why didn't you say sorry earlier? So I think if an organization needs to do something and they don't, then that's probably the point. You'll just lose trust. You'll lose consumer trust, and any other messages that you put out in the future, you know, they'll be met with real skepticism. So I think it's the action behind it, really, that's the point of no return.
I feel like it's time for a game.
When's it not time for a game?
A career game.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, Hannah, as you've said before, you were going to be a lawyer before you sidestepped that and went into communications instead. We were having a think about, I don't know, actually, Tom and Ollie, did you have plans to be something else before you became solicitors?
I wanted to be a pilot, actually.
That's cool.
But that never really took off. Hey.
It's why you wear the big headphones. It gets you feel a pilot.
You need aviators as well. I know.
But I don't think I would have a job now with the pandemic, but I don't think I'd be as busy as I am doing cyber, that's for sure. I don't know, flirted with lots of different things, to be honest. I never really wanted to be a lawyer, but I sort of drifted into it and then wanted to escape it. But then I found cyber and now I love it again. So, that's me.
My route to law pivoted in a hot tub with my dentist.
God, I'm having a vague recollection of this. Such a weird story.
I think I need to know more.
I did English language and linguistics at uni, and there was zero practical use with that, other than speech therapy. But then I saw what speech therapists are paid, and I thought, not keen on that. So I was kind of looking for something else to do. And I was in a jacuzzi and my dentist got in. I hadn't planned to meet my dentist in the jacuzzi. And then he was just saying, well, you're coming up to sort of finishing university now. And like, what are you going to do with yourself? I don't know. Well, you're going to have a family at some point. You're going to put bread on the table. To pull your socks up, look into law. My daughter's doing law. So I thought, oh, okay, I'll look into that. And so I kind of drifted towards it. And then somehow, before I knew it, I was a lawyer. But I sometimes think if I'd not got into that hot tub with my dentist, I never would have become a lawyer.
You make it sound like it was so easy to become a lawyer. Like you just woke up one day, qualified. No effort.
I think I was going to be a journalist for a while. Had sort of big ideas that I was going to be doing all this like investigative journalism, and then sort of did a bit of shadowing and realised that I would be reporting on cats and tutus and things like that, and just sort of decided that wasn't for me.
Where did you do your work experience?
some random places that let me in. It may turn out they weren't even, you know, news outlets. I was just shadowing some weird guy. Made me change my mind quickly. But in that vein, I found a very reputable quiz online, BuzzFeed quiz, which, based on a few questions about what you prefer, can determine to great accuracy what career is the right career for you. So I've got Tom and Ollie's answers, and we'll go through it with you now, Han, and okay. we'll see what it comes up with, whether your actual job appears or not. So you ready?
I'm ready. My boss is listening. I didn't ask them to do this. I'm not confused.
Okay. Number one, sweet or savory?
Sweet.
Inside or outside?
Outside.
City or country?
Country, every time. She says from London.
Day or night?
Day.
Words or numbers?
Words.
Stay in or go out?
Stay in.
Truth or dare?
Ooh, dare.
Risky. Autumn or spring?
Autumn, my birthday.
Books or TV?
TV. Don't have time to read. I read newspapers.
Oh, that's enough. Soup or salad?
Soup.
All black or colourful clothes?
All black.
Halloween or Christmas?
Christmas.
Fruit or vegetables?
Fruit.
Text or call?
Text.
Text. Simple or fancy food?
Simple.
Cat or dog?
Dog. Absolutely. So allergic to cats. I don't know what they're thinking.
You could get one of those little hairless ones.
Oh, no. Still don't know what they're thinking.
Cold or hot drinks?
Hot.
Hot.
But really only hot chocolate.
Comfort or style for clothes?
Comfort. It's been a pandemic.
Yeah, no, I was thinking that when I answered that one.
I don't remember anything about style.
Past or future?
Future.
Last one, chocolatey or fruity, as in desserts?
Chocolatey.
Chocolatey, okay.
Specifically M&S melt in the middle, not just a chocolate
pudding.
Oh, they're
so good.
Oh my gosh. If they ever stop selling those, goodness me.
Okay, this is interesting actually. So your recommended career gives you a few options. You could be a nurse or a social worker, an environmental scientist, a veterinarian, can never say that, a vet I should have just said, or a dentist. And the reason is because apparently you're a protector, so you've got a big heart and you deeply care about the world around you.
I think that's true in my personal life. Less so in what we do.
Well, we did it before, so mine, very interesting, gave me the option of lawyer.
Stay true to yourself.
Or computer programmer.
Oh, wow.
Or accountant. Oh, real sexy options there. And then Ollie and Tom, you came back with exactly the same, even though your answers were slightly different. So really? You had a few. You could have been an actor, a fashion designer like this, an influencer, a chef, or
yes,
a florist, which I can personally really see. Apparently it's because you're both uber creative people.
Fabulous.
With big personalities.
Yeah. Wow.
Would you say that's accurate?
Well, I hope not, seeing as it's just given me lawyer and accountant.
One of the things that I always find quite fascinating is that choice about putting people in front of the media spotlight following a breach. And there have been some quite high profile examples of CEOs going on Newsnight or going on news programs and, you know, getting a fairly tough ride. What are the parameters around those kind of decisions about whether you send someone like a victim up to explain themselves?
Firstly, don't try and frame them as the victim. Yeah, it's a conversation we have a lot. It does require us to be quite frank about who that person could be. So actually, a lot of the time, it's a question of, is there anyone who would do this if we wanted to anyway? And often, actually, there isn't. You know, an IT person, if you're talking about a breach situation, an IT person is probably feeling like it's way too close to them. They'll get way too into the detail. The other, we get suggested maybe the CFO could do it or a commercial officer, but then you're just all about the money and that doesn't give the right impression at all. So, and you know, even a CEO or a COO may not actually know the detail of what's happened to have an interview. You know, you actually have to have a reasonable amount of content to have a decent interview and not just be one of those really awkward ones that becomes famous for being an awkward interview. So who would do it anyway is a really good question that we have to always ask ourselves. And we will be really honest and say, actually, yes, you might think this person can do it because they do all sorts of fun interviews all the time, but in this situation, they're not right. But then I think beyond that, it's what are you actually trying to achieve with this? You know, do you actually need to put somebody out, be it a recorded video or an interview, to achieve what you need to achieve from the brand? Is it to reassure people or is it to provide information? And a lot of the time, I think in these, if you're talking about a breach situation where there's loads of operational disruption, for example, you know, the amount of comms we do, we're providing information. You guys have seen it yourselves. An FAQ document is so long. There's no way someone in the space of a matter of an hours can, you know, revise all that detail. So again, what actually is it going to achieve by having somebody come and be the face of an incident? I think, you know, you really want to reserve those kind of interviews or videos for internal, maybe, if it's expected of you. That makes sense, knowing it might obviously end up being external if there's a leak of some kind. But also, just what help is that to the situation? An incident like a breach, any kind of ransomware attack, whatever it might be, shouldn't define a brand. It's not a big enough crisis, it shouldn't be, to define a brand. So if you're in that territory where operationally you're so screwed that you're talking, you know, weeks and weeks of disruption, then maybe you'll need to. But it shouldn't be a defining moment for you as an organization, in my opinion. It's an issue. It's something you have to deal with. It's a hurdle. You get over it. You carry on. And in all likelihood, let's be honest, it's probably going to happen again.
And so in those situations where you're agreeing to put someone forward, mm-hmm. or the company is, and you're then presumably coaching that individual who's going to go forward. I mean, how granular is that coaching? Are you going through individual questions that are probably going to be asked? And to what extent do you get any visibility on the questions that are going to be asked during an interview from the journalist?
So it really depends on what stage you'd be putting them out for an interview. If it's really early stages, you don't have to go that granular about the incident, because as you know, we'll have to fall back on the fact that it's still being investigated. There's a lot you don't know, and sort of give a lot of different ways that you can say that same thing. So in the early stages, it's not too much. It's more about sort of tone and what else you can talk about, and making sure that the proactive action you're taking is sort of front and center of the message. You obviously know who you're being interviewed by, and you know what their historic behavior has been like, whether it's with that organization or with others. So you know if it's going to be a bit more brutal, if they are knowledgeable about cyber, so that they might ask more detailed questions in that way. So yeah, I mean, absolutely, we should be in a position to predict the kind of questions that you're going to be asked and give key answers for those. For the spokesperson, as much as they feel comfortable with, or they'll come up with the answers, and then we just kind of run it over with them. Does that work? What might we want to change? And remind them of the key messages that we need to land, which are there for good reason. You know, normally in a breach incident, people just need to know what it means for them. So we've got to make sure those messages come across. But yes, you'll always get in a situation where a journalist maybe asks a question that you didn't exactly predict. But hopefully all the other work that you would have done and the other messages that you would have given them and the techniques to bridge, which is what we call it, away from that question to answer in a way that is easier to do so, but still informative and useful. That's the kind of prep that we would do to help them.
And there must be circumstances where you come on board in a breach where there has already been some comms activity. And presumably, often that comms activity isn't always helpful. And I'm sure we're both thinking of the same incident, which was probably the playbook on how to get it wrong.
Yeah.
But how hard is it to row back from the comms that have been put out there before you come on board by people who aren't necessarily skilled at that particular discipline?
Mm. We are definitely thinking of the same thing. it's not easy. It's really, really important that although we're an external consultant and we may not work with this brand all the time, so we don't always know their tone of voice, we have to adopt their tone and how they normally talk as best we can, as quickly as possible. So what we would do is take the communications they've used and try and, you know, input as much as we can what they should really be saying, but adopt their tone so there's a level of consistency and it doesn't sort of scream of, oh, this is when they got an external consultant involved, I can tell. The hardest thing, which is what we had on this incident, I think we're both thinking of, is when a message goes out in sort of bold and red and actually it's not correct. And so, for example, in this world that we work in, we've had a data breach. And actually, you only know you've had a cyber incident, but still there are a lot of organizations and individuals who don't quite get the difference between the two. And having to row back from saying we've had a data breach to saying we don't know if we've had a data breach, and then potentially having to go out when you do know you've had a data breach, that is just so messy and complicated. So we have to work really hard to what you then have to do is explain why that message is changing, without saying, you know, we were wrong, we didn't know any better. just have to almost go into more detail as to what actually was meant in the first comms that went out, and then why we're moving everybody to a different message now. And I think nowadays, because it is reported so much in the press a bit more, if you do explain things, people tend to respond better to that. So we've recently had to start explaining a lot more why you don't know if there's been a data breach for such a long period of time, or why you don't know how this incident occurred in the first place. So we're now explaining in so much more detail what goes into a forensic investigation. And now that's landing much better. Whereas in the past, we never had to do that. People just accepted it. So it's interesting to see how that's changing as well.
Consumers are definitely getting more savvy, aren't they? And they're definitely starting to understand what ransomware means. And the questions, therefore, are getting more direct for organizations. And so I found that over the past maybe 12 months or so, we've definitely change direction in terms of the level of detail that we're giving, even if it's not in the initial or main comms in the FAQs, we're giving a lot more detail in terms of the steps that we're taking.
Yeah, I think people have become more familiar with ransomware, but I don't know if they understand still that because ransomware is dominated, you can still have cyber incidents that aren't ransomware. So equally with that, you get the challenge. People say, well, it is ransomware though, isn't it? They're not saying it is, but it is. And actually it isn't. Or we don't know if it is yet. So it kind of works in different ways as well. And the other thing is it's different per market. So obviously Fleischmann's global company, we've got colleagues who do this exact job in other markets. And their consumer response is so different because it's not being reported as frequently in the press and it's not so common. So you have to be really careful that when we are notifying data subjects in, say, 5 different markets, how the comms might change in the different markets, where they are, you know, potentially going to have quite a scared, anxious response from people in one market versus, to be honest, in the UK, when consumers are a bit more like, well, you know, here we go again, had this last week. So that's interesting too.
Yeah, that is interesting actually, because I guess within your organization, do you have a sort of internal bank of information and knowledge about any given country or jurisdiction in terms of what the press situation is like, what the relationship is with the press, what the key newspapers are and things like that, just in case something comes up? Do you store that sort of information?
Mostly it's in the heads of everybody. So there's a lot we wouldn't write down, mm-hmm. particularly about how journalists behave. So it's well worth picking up the phone, just asking colleagues of what they've seen. But it's also not even on the media side. So we tend to find, and I'm sure it's the same for you, that if we have a threat actor behaving a particular way in the US, actually, it might be a couple of weeks until we see that in the UK. But then by that point, we've learned a lot from the first 2 weeks that it was in the US, for example. So we have a lot of kind of scheduled and every other week or not calls where we're just, you know, sharing information, sharing trends. What's the latest? What's gone down really well? Who's new on the scene? What journalists are starting to dig around a bit more, that kind of thing, and share that information. Broader stakeholders too, you know, how are shareholders responding? How are analysts responding? Because our job isn't just the media, it's all stakeholders who you have to communicate with when you go through something like this. So we tend to share that information on the regular anyway, but if an incident comes up in a particular market, then it's just about picking up the phone and saying, we need your local expertise. So, you know, either jump on board or tell me what you know.
And in terms of the relationships that you guys have with journalists, for example, do you have key people within your organization that has those relationships? And so if there's any particular journalist, do you look internally in terms of who might be able to have that rapport with that particular individual to buy some time or try and pacify the situation. What I'm saying is, do they rely on you as well? So is there that relationship where you can have a bit of a trade-off in terms of what they do or what they don't publish?
I think the days of people saying, if you don't publish this story, I'll give you that story, are extremely rare. It doesn't happen with businesses. You're really looking at kind of the dirtier world of individual work, I'd say. Our teams absolutely have different journalists they are much friendlier with or much more familiar with based on what sector they work in or what expertise the journalist covers and the clients they have on a day-to-day basis. But in terms of, you know, managing different incidents, we come across the same type of journalists in the cyberspace. But also very quickly on an incident, you just get to know the journalist who's involved. And when you're tackling an issue like this, we're not trying to sell something. So that's the kind of difference with normal PR. We have the story, and in a way we have some of the power. So we get to, you know, journalists are quite good to get to know quite quickly on projects like this, because you have information, they need information. And the more you have adult and open conversations with them, or at least they think they do, you know, the better it is kind of in the longer term. It's when a journalist thinks they know something which isn't true that it gets into trickier territory. But, you know, that's our job. Our job is to get those relationships with the journalist quickly if we don't already have them, and try and educate them a bit. You know, we do background briefings, obviously, with the approval of clients and everything, to make sure they know what they should and shouldn't be writing. And only if we really need to do we have to pull you guys in.
Well, that brings us to the end of another episode of Cyber Sounds. First of all, thank you so much to Hannah Cambridge for being a brilliant guest. And thanks very much for listening. As always, if you like what you hear, please like and share on social. And if you need any other information about our cyber offering at Kennedy's, just search Kennedy's Cyber. And you'll find our details and ways to contact us. We'll see you again soon on Cyber Sounds.